time once again for Indie Week. And I'm John Federson with a weekly program over the North Carolina Reading Service called Indie Week. And the date of this particular broadcast and issue is July the 14th of 2023. And as always, North Carolina Reading Service presents this for our blind and print-impaired listeners. We'll begin with Tomasi McDonald, our regular Durham correspondent for Indie Week, with a book review of all things. And it begins this way. Durham historian Blair L.M. Kelly's newly published Black Folk, The Roots of the Black Working Class, is one of the greatest books I have read about labor in America. The fascinating, revealing, at times heartbreaking, yet inspiring 319-page volume chronicles the role of the black working class who contributed mightily to this country's wealth and development as a global superpower. Early on in the volume, Kelly, who is the incoming director of UNC Chapel Hill's Center for the Study of the American South and co-directs the Southern Futures Initiative, points out, quote, "In our current political culture, the white working class is synonymous with supporters of Donald Trump. But the notion that the American working class is white is an assumption that long predates Trump's time in office." Black Folk renders clear what 19th century historian Laura Wilkes described as the missing pages of history. Black workers who, quote, "from the slavery to the present, have been essential to the nation's productivity and indeed, as was demonstrated during the COVID pandemic, to its basic functioning." This national mythos, Kelly asserts, leaves little room for black voters. He writes, "Rarely do we speak of how the nation's racial hierarchy of segregation and discrimination sought to ensure that black people would always labor in a stratum below white people. When black people are mentioned at all, the very idea of work is dropped entirely, and instead they are described as poor and often implied to be unworthy and unproductive." Kelly's assertion echoes an observation by the triangle photographer Titus Higgins in the late 1990s, that it's hard to talk about work in America and not talk about black folk. Kelly's writing focuses on enslaved laborers, sharecroppers, washerwomen, maids, postal workers, and Pullman porters. And at the heart of her work, both literally and figuratively, are members of the author's own family tree, who take center stage to tell the story about the roots of America's black working class. There's the gripping story of her maternal grandfather, John D., who was 14 when his father, Solicitor Duncan, loaded his family and their belongings onto a horse-drawn wagon and stole away from Georgia to North Carolina one night to escape his lot as a sharecropper, following a year of grueling work in which he still came out owing the white landowner. D passed in 1990. Kelly writes, as they made their way up the hilly dirt road, D didn't even look back at the tiny house where they had lived, a converted slave cabin just a few miles away from where generations of his ancestors had toiled in bondage. He imagined what runaway slaves must have felt. While contemplating reparations for today's descendants, Kelly chronicles the life of one of those enslaved ancestors, a boy born sometime in 1822 named Henry, who became a blacksmith. Quote, "Henry as a child probably began working, carrying water, gathering wood, working with child-sized tools soon after he could walk. Meanwhile, The man who held Henry in bondage, Joseph Rucker, was the largest and wealthiest slaveholder in Elbert County, Georgia. Rucker's land and property on the eve of the Civil War were valued in figures that today would equal more than $9.3 million. But in spite of existence under such brutal conditions, the black working class, even during slavery, created community. At the center of America's enslaved ancestors' community was the church, which Kelly describes as an invisible institution maintained behind brittle, broken branches in the woods, a faith that would buttress a black working class. She chronicles the quiet resolve and resistance of the lowly washerwoman who used her independence to organize and demand fair wages while taking care of their own homes and children away from the watchful eyes of white clients. She points to the efforts of Callie Guy House, a formerly enslaved washerwoman who, in 1898, the same year as the Wilmington Massacre, became the first black woman to rise to national prominence as a leader in the fight for reparations. Two concurrent themes run through the pages of Black Folk: the fight by the black working class to create better working conditions in the face of systemic injustice, and white outrage that often took the form of violence to attack black enterprise and self-sufficiency. The former led to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, an all-black railway union that became one of the most powerful organizations in the country, and the National Alliance of Postal Employees, the precursor to the National Alliance of Postal and Federal Employees. The latter, two descendants of formerly enslaved people, James Uzzle, an educator, and Samuel Burton, owned a grocery store in Accomack County, Virginia. In 1907, the two men were targeted by local whites who feared that the annual agricultural fair the two men sponsored, quote, was actually a movement center for black working class labor resistance. Following separate instances of physical attacks and charges of attempted murder after Burton shot one of his attackers in the leg, a mob descended fully armed through Onacock, firing hundreds of bullets into Burton's store before torching it. When neither Burton nor Uzzle emerged from the burning building, hundreds of white men set about terrorizing local black farmers and shooting into the homes of black sharecroppers. Kelly concludes her rich saga by considering the move of much of her family from Georgia to Thomasville, North Carolina, where they were denied skilled work in the furniture industry and instead lived on its margins. So they swept the floors and assembled the boxes in the dusty factories, cleaned the homes, and did the laundry of the white factory managers. When the scholar considers the tuberculosis outbreak that killed members of her family and how it preyed on the bodies of the working poor, particularly black people, she notes its parallel to the COVID pandemic and its disproportionate impact on black Americans. She wrote, "More than 28% of 42 million black people in America today, the majority of the black working class, are essential workers," she writes. Kelly concludes her work in praise of her ancestors and their descendants who have an inheritance all their own. Their story, too, is the American story. Another regular Indie Week columnist, Lena Geller, writes about tenants living on Durham's Open Air Camp Road. "The biggest thing for me," Sheba Everett says, "is that my six-year-old will be able to say, 'This is my childhood home. This is the home I grew up in.'" On cue, six-year-old Hannah, the youngest of Everett's five daughters, pokes her head out from behind a staircase banister and grins. "We're sitting in the living room of a brick five-bedroom on Open Air Camp Road in Durham, situated several hundred feet from the banks of the Eno River, with a front yard so large that a trampoline, fire pit, and a brawny rope swing-strung oak tree barely put a dent in its real estate. It's a home that Everett spent much of the past year fighting to keep. In spring of this year, the effort proved successful. Everett is one of 27 tenants who faced displacement when the Eno River Association, the ERA, a land trust and conservation nonprofit, issued eviction notices last year as part of a long-held plan to sell an 18-acre land parcel and the seven homes that occupy it to the State Parks Department. The state intended to use the homes as free housing for park rangers. As Indy previously reported, the tenants, some of whom have inhabited the homes for a decade or more, were shocked when notices to vacate were posted on their doors in September. The ERA had not disclosed that the properties, affordably leased since the 1890s, were being held for a future transfer. In fact, property management company V.S. Rich Property Services had repeatedly assured tenants that they could stay on Open Air Camp Road as long as they liked, and one day initiate rent-to-own agreements. With that in mind, many had endured poor living conditions and invested their own dollars into repairs that property management refused to make. Parentheses, Jessica Sheffield, executive director of ERA, previously told the Indy that property management staff had assured her they had made the repairs tenants requested, and she doesn't know why tenants were never notified of the planned sale to the state. The eviction notices gave some households 10 months to vacate. Others were afforded less than two. Given current rent prices in Durham, displacement for most tenants would mean leaving the area or state, or at worst, encountering homelessness. So they organized. And after months of incremental progress, the tenants forged a legal agreement with the ERA. The organization published an insert for the festival for the Eno in the Indy last month, presenting a rescindment of those eviction notices and a plan to transfer most of the houses to a housing nonprofit that will ensure, quote, they're forever protected as affordable homes in Durham. The ERA has also waived tenants' rental payments since October and worked on needed repairs, according to that insert. In an email to Indy, Sheffield wrote the organization cannot currently discuss further details of the agreement, including the identity of the housing nonprofit, due to a confidentiality clause in the land transaction. In North Carolina, where tenant protections are scarce, winning an eviction case is rare. And winning a case in this way, where tenants can remain in their homes and start on a path to land trust ownership, and where permanently affordable housing is created in a lush neighborhood with shade and slow street traffic, is likely unprecedented. So, how did they pull this off? When Sheba Everett received an eviction notice, her household was one of three given less than 2 months to vacate. She immediately asked friends and co-workers to call the ERA. Branches Community School, where Everett works as a preschool teacher, launched a GoFundMe on her behalf. In a letter paired with that fundraiser, Everett bared her soul. She was a single mother with three jobs, she wrote. The same day she received the eviction notice, her elder daughter's car was totaled during a hit and run. She has recently exhausted her savings to pay for her late brother's funeral expenses and support the children he left behind. She was reluctant to ask for help, she wrote, but she needed it. I had no organizing experience, says Everett, who has lived on Open Air Camp Road with her daughter since early 2020. I don't know what to do, so I was just like, I'm going to tell my community. A few days later, Everett came home to find a letter taped to her front door. It was from her neighbors, Leslie, former Leslie Dreyer, and Jadelyn Saint-Dre, a couple with more than a decade of organizing experience, who had recently moved to Durham with their child following displacement from the Bay Area. The Saint-Dres weren't ERA tenants, they told Everett, but could help strategize around fighting the eviction. Everett was game. They began knocking on doors. Leslie says, "We started by talking to people about their connection to the homes. We asked, 'Do you want to stay here?' Which is different from, 'Do you believe you can stay here?' If the latter question is posed, the conversation typically comes to a screeching halt," she explained. "But when people are encouraged to discuss the experiences they've had in a home, they internalize their right to remain there. Like most long-term tenants who pay off entire mortgages on homes via rent and get no equity, several ERA tenants realized that they had invested more money into their homes than their landlords. They wanted to push back. Once a few houses were willing to fight, it built solidarity," said Leslie, "and the houses who might have been reticent were down." Graham Jones was one of the reticent. He has lived in ERA property for his entire adult life. He's occupied his current rental for nearly two decades, and before that spent several years in a different house, an open-air camp that was torn down when it fell into disrepair. Like other tenants, Jones and his wife, who preferred it not to be named, sensed that something was awry in June of 2022. This was several months before receiving a notice to vacate, when state park rangers and ERA board members did a walkthrough of their home, an inspection that seemed to forebode an upcoming sale. Jones says, "I mentioned multiple times we were expecting a new child, and I really needed to know if we were safe, but they acted like we had nothing to worry about. We were moving around the furniture in the rooms, and they said, 'Keep moving everything.'" But his suspicions were confirmed in September, when a neighboring tenant divulged an eviction notice was en route. The message was terrifying. Jones's wife was 8 months pregnant. The couple's other child, a teenage daughter, had a medical condition requiring regular treatment from specialists at Duke Hospital. Displacement from open-air camp would have meant displacement from the Triangle and the state, Jones says, and losing proximity to his daughter's health care. Despite all this, when Jadelyn knocked on Jones' door a few weeks later, Jones was hesitant. "We felt like if we stuck our necks out there, they were just going to kick us out before the date. That was a huge fear." He also had concerns about what it would mean to challenge a beloved local organization that had a robust supporter base. Seemed more daunting than taking on a single faceless landlord. But Jadelyn's enthusiasm and other tenants' involvement ultimately swayed him. Jones says, "The fact that we were able to come together as a group, that made me think maybe we had the power to get things changed." By early October, all seven households were on board, and the Eno River Tenants Association, ERTA, held its first official meeting. Everett said, "In the beginning, we all just talked to make sure everybody wanted the same results. It was important for us to all be on the same page." The tenants' shared goals were recast as a list of demands for the ERA. Rescind the notices to vacate. Restore damaged homes to healthy, habitable standards, and transfer the homes to tenant ownership using a shared equity land trust model, among other demands. Since the ERA had refused to rescind the eviction notices when confronted privately, tenants decided to go public with their demands and published an online petition. The petition garnered more than 700 signatures and worked to aggregate evidence of widespread support while functioning as a direct line of communication between ERTA and its advocates. That line of communication was vital. On one end, tenants received ongoing morale boosts from petition supporters, who paired their signatures with encouraging words. On the other end, supporters, all of whom provided contact information via the petition, received emails with status updates and calls to action. Toward the end of October, the ERTA sent a message asking supporters to join them in staging a surprise demonstration at the ERA's annual meeting. ERA likely got wind of the plan. Tenants all received last-minute invitations to speak at the meeting taped to their doors. Parentheses. Per the ERA, the timing of the meeting, quote, aligned well with our interest in getting together with tenant families to hear directly from them and further our dialogue. But tenants showing up and delivering personal testimonies ultimately proved disruptive anyway. Many ERA members and several newer board members stated they were hearing about this land transfer's human impact and conditions for the first time. We'd been out of sight, out of mind, Everett says, so we got in sight. 5 days after the meeting and 2 days after the Indy reported on the pending evictions, ERA announced it would push back eviction dates by several months, waive all rents effective immediately, and investigate allegations of tenant mistreatment by V.S. Rich Property Services. Several board members also started advocating to the rest of the organization on tenants' behalf, says Leslie. The next month, after the News and Observer published a story and accompanying video detailing Everett's fight against displacement as a single black mother, the ERA almost immediately announced it had tabled the sale of the homes to the State Parks Department. In that same announcement, the ERA apologized to tenants and stated that it had, quote, made mistakes throughout the process. Getting into sight was making an impact. Everett, who prefaced her September fundraiser memo with the line, feeling too proud to ask and too embarrassed to let people in, I almost opted out of writing this letter today, but who ultimately emerged as the chief spokesman of ERTA, says speaking openly was a crucial skill she honed over the months-long organizing effort. And she says, if you're ever faced with something like this, it'll be hard to be vulnerable with your community. But for me, being vulnerable with my community has been one of the biggest and most beautiful experiences that I've ever had. Even with publicity and community support, though, fatigue set in by January. The ERA still hadn't rescinded those eviction notices, leaving tenants in a precarious position. If they spent their free time organizing, they risked running out of time to find housing if the effort failed. If even a few of them exited ERTA to devote time to house hunting, the group could lose its collective powers. And if, like Everett, they tried to both organize and look for new homes while working a full-time job and raising a family, their health would deteriorate. Everett says, I was getting sick, physically, mentally. I couldn't handle it. The limbo was making me feel like I'm teeter-tottering on the edge of a bridge, not knowing if I'm going to be down there with the sharks. Jones was also on the brink. Quote, the uncertainty of everything made it feel like it would almost be better just to give up and figure another situation, he says, but found solace in the growing list of petition signatures, which made him feel like we weren't wrong for pushing what we felt was right. Everett ultimately turned to God for guidance, he says, and received a message. The house is yours. Stop looking. She complied. In February, things started to align. ERA expressed interest in learning more about the shared equity land trust housing models that IRTA had outlined in its petition, reaching out for a meeting with an organization the tenants had recommended. After that, the first ERTA meeting was scheduled for late February, with the two groups agreeing that a mediator and legal scholar should attend to assist with the process. For that mediator role, Erta recommended Manju Rajendran, a conflict transformation facilitator. Rajendran's laboratory lens was crucial, says Leslie, noting that a legal-oriented mediator likely would not have acknowledged the harms done to tenants. Leslie says this whole fight was about ethics, not legality, so we had to have facilitators who understood that major part of the struggle. Professor Andrew Foster and a team of students with Duke Law Community Enterprise Clinic would provide collaborative legal support to help both parties iron out the terms of a mutual agreement. Tenants were still in limbo after the first meeting, but at the next, Leslie said the ERA came prepared to make decisions. Soon after, in early May, ERTA emailed petition supporters with major news. Its second meeting with the ERA was indeed transformative and had led to a breakthrough agreement, setting them on a path to meet our core demands. Everett, whose previous dwelling was an apartment where she and her daughters all slept in a single room, doubled up on mattresses on the floor, can now stay in her place of peace, she says. Jones, a longtime trail runner, is excited that his family will continue to have access to Eno River State Park. His eight-month-old will grow up hiking and fishing just like his older daughter did. His wife plans to build a garden. We feel very linked to this land. In some ways, this was an anomalous eviction battle. Unlike most landlords, the ERA primarily relies on contributions from hundreds of local community members to stay afloat, so public pressure carried weight. The ERA is also a preservation-focused organization with a mission statement that says its work, quote, is mostly necessary due to colonial practices and an economic system of land use and ownership that have dispossessed many peoples of color. The tenants could cite the mission as proof that rescinding notices would align with the organization's core values. But there are also key elements of the victory, like the sturdy scaffolding of community support that gave tenants the strength they needed to persist, that can be replicated elsewhere. Leslie says, we need homeowner allies to understand that they too benefit from stable communities. Everyone wins from decommodifying housing and making sure that it's prioritized for human needs and not for profit. All right, and we'll move to Jasmine Gallup with yet another housing-based, what a surprise, article in Indy Week. New fund aims to preserve affordable housing in Wake County, but even mission-based landlords struggle to keep rents low, is the title. When it comes to affordable housing in the Triangle, even mission-driven developers like CASA can struggle. The Raleigh-based nonprofit has a goal to provide vulnerable people access to affordable housing. In November of 2022, it took steps to achieve that goal with the purchase of Grosvenor Gardens, a historic apartment complex on Hillsborough Street. So last month, when CASA unexpectedly raised rents there by 30 to 50%, residents felt blindsided, they told news outlets. Jess Brandis, CASA's senior director of real estate development, says the decision to raise rents was an unfortunate necessity. Even with the help of government funding, CASA's purchase of the property means the nonprofit has to pay off a pretty steep mortgage, she says. Quote, the amount of equity we would have needed to get from our local partners to keep rents exactly where they were exceeded what was available. Our intent with this purchase was to keep it affordable for 30 years, knowing that there would be likely zero affordability of all if anyone else bought it. CASA bought that property with the help of about $7 million from Wake County's Affordable Housing Preservation Fund, WAHPF. WAF. A pot of money aimed at preserving affordable apartments and other housing. The idea is that instead of selling a property to a developer who will raise rents to levels many can't afford, properties are sold to developers who agree to keep these rents low. Unfortunately, affordable means different things to developers who operate based on what the markets dictate, and renters who often can't afford market rates. In Wake County's hyper-competitive real estate market, a one-bedroom apartment now goes for about $1,250 per month. That means even if developers build or buy below market rate housing, low-income renters may struggle to personally afford it. Case in point, at Grosvenor Gardens, some residents will now pay $1,100 per month for a one-bedroom unit. That's a $300 hike over that previous rent of $800. For CASA, keeping rents that low is a struggle. Similar one beds in the same area rent for at least $1,300 a month, but for many Raleighites, that means having to pack up and move out of the apartment complex and, likely, out of the city entirely. In the end, the success or failure of CASA's endeavor to keep housing affordable comes down to the funding they can secure to buy a property. Brandis says it's a math problem. If you're buying a $10 million building and you can only take out a $5 million loan and the city only has $4 million of other money available, you're still $1 million short. So you either don't do the deal at all those people get displaced and the units are lost forever, or you go, okay, we're going to have to stretch these rents somehow, increase the income limits or something to get over that hump. CASA's goal, Brandis says, is to keep the property affordable in the long term. The nonprofit doesn't want to see people displaced, but it must either raise rents by $300 now or see them go up by $500 or more in the future. By purchasing the property, CASA can also control what rents will be in 15 or 30 years. For example, in 2015, CASA bought a 42-apartment complex called Sunnybrook Village, located in southeast Raleigh. At the time, apartments were renting at market rate. Additionally, the owners did not accept renters who paid with the help of government subsidies, like housing vouchers. CASA was able to buy the property with the help of money from Wake County, the city of Raleigh, and a low-interest loan from a bank. Brandis says, we now have 11 units set aside for people with disabilities. We're accepting rental subsidies at that property. Brandis adds, CASA has units set aside for renters under 40, 60, and 80% of the area median income. That's the AMI. For one person, that's about $79,000 per year. So she says, we're achieving this real mixed income model where we've kind of got a whole spectrum of people. Brandis says, if CASA had not bought Sunnybrook Village in 2015, you and I know exactly what it would be like right now. All the rents would be as high as they could go. They wouldn't be accepting subsidies. It's really looking at that long view of retaining affordability over the next several decades. In today's housing market, finding money to purchase property in Raleigh is a challenge, Brandis says. CASA also often cobbles together funding from multiple sources like local Raleigh and Wake County programs, federal government low housing income housing tax credit program, loans from private banks, donations from fundraising campaigns. Some of that funding is cash the organization can spend freely, like grants or donations. There's no interest, they don't have to pay it back, and they can use it wherever it's needed. But a lot more of the funding consists of loans money CASA has to pay back with interest and within a certain amount of time. That's where things get tricky. One limiting factor is something Brandis calls soft debt, a loan with little or no interest. These loans act more like grants or donations, since they may have a long 10 to 30 year timeline for repayment or be forgivable. Traditional real estate loans with higher interest rates are also available, but if CASA wants to keep rent affordable, they have to keep the mortgage down, which means they need more soft debt than hard debt. WAHPF is a helpful program, but Brandis does not consider it soft debt, she says. Interest rates there range from about 4 to 6%. One of the goals of WAHPF is to give affordable housing developers fast access to a source of funding, says Mark Perlman, who's the division director of the Wake County Housing Department. Organizations like CASA can get a loan from that fund much more quickly than grants or other money from county or city governments. Perlman says that's essential in today's real estate market, where a property can come on the market and be gone within 30 days. We felt it was imperative to have a product that can move faster than we can, to give our partners a little bit more edge. So far, CASA is the only organization to take advantage of the fund, although there are several projects in the pipeline, according to Perlman. In addition to securing funding, developers face another challenge in finding affordable properties to buy. Interest in the fund has slowed somewhat after the first loan was completed last year, says John Freilich, one of the administrators of the fund at the Self-Help Credit Union. He says, "We're hoping to engage with folks who may have affordable properties, naturally occurring in particular, who want to keep them preserved but are wanting to sell them. It remains a very challenging market, but as economic times kind of go up and down, there may be opportunities to come up, so it's great to have this fund ready to take advantage of those." Freilich also helped manage Durham's Affordable Housing Preservation Fund, which has successfully loaned out some $10 million for the construction or preservation of affordable housing since its inception in 2019. Although it's still a new program, far more money, about $61 million, is available in the WAHPF, much of that coming from private contributions. The Wake County contributed $10.5 million of taxpayer money. Whether the WAHPF will be as effective as officials hope remains to be seen. As in many other city and county programs, developers like CASA are eligible for WAHPF funding only if they use it to buy affordable properties. In this case, the county defines affordable property as housing with rents that are affordable for someone making at or below 80% of the median income in the area. Some activists argue those income limits are too high and won't help the people who are truly vulnerable to homelessness. In Wake County, a person earning 80% AMI makes about $64,000 a year, which means an affordable monthly rent for a one-bedroom is defined at $1,700 per month. That's already beyond what many in Wake County can afford and far more expensive than the $750 to $1,000 per month apartments the area is losing in droves. According to the fund's guidelines, preference will go to housing that serves people making 60% AMI or below, but that's still means an affordable monthly rent for a one-bedroom apartment can cost up to $1,275 per month, roughly on par with the market rate rent of $1,250. The fund isn't strictly limited to property owners renting to people who earn 60 to 80%. Some affordable properties may fund, the county may fund, do have rents below maximum allowable levels, says Perlman. In addition, one major goal of the fund is to prevent the displacement of existing low and moderate income tenants. But the fund's rules leave that responsibility in the hands of developers like CASA, which may be limited in how much money it can spend on affordable property. Still, Wake County officials are hopeful. They anticipate that WAF will help keep about 3,200 apartments or other housing units in the county affordable for at least the next 15 years, according to the county website. And Perlman says, Raleigh and Wake County is a very attractive market for investors to acquire existing properties, do a little bit of rehab, and then significantly increase the rent. We're losing affordable units almost faster than we can build them. So the Preservation Fund is intended to help plug that gap. And again from Tomasi McDonald. How will Durham leaders address the mental health impacts on children living with gun violence? Josiah Jennings is a rising 11th grader at Hillside High. He was one of a handful of nearly two dozen high school students who performed in State of Urgency, a theater production that addressed the impact of gun violence in their lives. The personable teen wants to attend college to study film and television. He says the ongoing specter of youth gun violence can be devastating and traumatic for him and his peers. Quote, it's important to have some type of mental health assistance to make sure people can get the help they need in our community and nationwide as well. While witnessing and living with the grim reality of their peers getting caught in the line of gunfire, Durham's young people are hurting. And they're asking the community for mental health tools to help them process the impact of gun violence. Jennings added, it can break a person down, but I think there's hope for people to be helped. The Bull City has borne witness to the awful pageantry of gun violence that has stolen the lives of children in communities all over the country. 1 year ago this month, the Kaiser Family Foundation reported firearms are now the number one cause of death for children and teens in the United States, surpassing motor vehicle deaths and those caused by other injuries. Two more children were gunned down in Durham last week. The 15-year-old girl survived the shooting and the 5-year-old girl died. There used to be a time when if a 5-year-old was shot and killed, the world would stand up and take notice. Nowadays, it's just another Wednesday. In recent months, the public conversation about youth gun violence in Durham has shifted from prevention to how it may be affecting young people's mental health. Child psychologists say children who are exposed to gun violence may experience post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety, along with diminished school performance, increased absenteeism, and difficulty concentrating. Charnequa Kennedy is director of counseling at NC Central University. She previously worked with a nonprofit focused on youth development, and Kennedy says a major concern for mental health providers are the increasing numbers of young people exposed to violence who experience trauma without the opportunity to process the incidents. She adds that because of the frequency of gunfire, people have become desensitized. That itself is a traumatic response that should be addressed, says Kennedy. She adds that the biggest concern for children and young adults exposed to gun violence is for their safety, both physically and psychologically. She says symptoms related to experiences involving gunfire include anger, headaches, gastrointestinal issues. Anaya Lowe, 18, recently graduated from Hillside and will attend NCANT University to pursue a degree in journalism. A lot of times, Lowe says, when tragic things happen, we really don't know how it affects us until we talk about it. I didn't know it affected me at all until I spoke about it. Kelly's Rael, 18, just graduated from Josephine Dobbs Clement Early College High School at NC Central, Rahel says it's important to focus on mental health and acknowledge it. She says, in today's society, our youths are getting more than we should. We see a lot of violence, a lot of hate. We need to find some unity. Here in Durham, police report that of the 20 homicides investigated this year by detectives, roughly one quarter of the victims have been 19-year-old or younger. Now, the article then goes on to list several instances of those specifically. Then continues, there have been 455 shootings in Durham through June 24th, according to Durham police. By comparison, last year, during that same period, 370 reports. And in 2021, 389. The age and race of the city's shooting victims are telling. Of the 90 people shot this year, 35 were 20 years old or younger. 21 of them were 17 or younger. Then there's more instances of individual students. But they zero in on Anthony Feaster. He was shot to death near Hillside High, where students in his performing arts were in final week of rehearsal for State of Urgency. Taryn Melvin is a 16-year-old rising junior in the early college high school. On the day that Feaster was fatally wounded, Melvin was aboard a bus traveling to Hillside for play rehearsals. The bus went to Pearson Elementary instead. We were all confused and didn't know what was going on, says Melvin. Then someone told me someone had gotten shot at Hillside. We've become so desensitized. My thought was, again? It just happened again? Many Hillside students learned via social media that Feaster, who had attended the school, had died. Melvin says when she walked into the drama room later that day, her fellow performers looked frightened, hurt, and scared. The look on their faces said, this is really real. This really happened. Someone is really gone. A student is really gone. And as I did not know Anthony personally, but I have a couple friends who knew him, my heart was broken for them. State of Urgency premiered in late 2021 during a ceasefire organized by city leaders and activists during one of the city's bloodiest years on record. The play's reprise this year was sponsored by the sheriff's office. Nearly 5,000 youngsters attended. The production served as a catharsis and call for community action, a healthy counterpoint featuring the voices of young people through poetry, stories, monologues, songs, and dances, all augmented by music and videos showing how violence has shaped their lives and worldviews. Tiffany Agerston, who replaced Hillside's legendary theater director Wendell Tabb this year, says the school went into secure position the day Feaster was shot. No one was allowed in the school or let out, says Agerston, who lost her brother Imani Ricks to gun violence in 2019. She says she didn't know why the school went into security posture until she attended a staff meeting immediately after school to let us know what was going on. Melvin says something was off during the rehearsal after that shooting. We understood what happened, but desensitization kicked in, and this happened again, she says. Kelsey Rael says a family member who works at Hillside told her about the shooting before she arrived at that rehearsal. Confusion and shock reigned in the drama room. She says we were all taken aback by it, but trying not to show it and go on. The former director, Tab, has continued to work with the production and is preparing it for a statewide tour. He says although the slain student was not involved in Hillside Performing Arts program, the shooting provided an opportunity for students to share their feelings about the pervasive gunplay in neighborhoods throughout the city. Agerston agrees. She says, during our rehearsal that day, it was something we had to process together. It helped us realize why doing this play is so relevant. This has happened today, and these are the very issues we are talking about. Melvinson Agerston's guidance was crucial after the shooting. She recalls how some of her castmates try to cope with Feaster's death by laughing it off. Society appears unmoved by the deaths of so many young people, and that's trickled down to the impacted students. It was a surreal moment, says Melvin. Miss A tells us everything happens for a reason. She gave us a pep talk before the rehearsal in the drama room and let us know this issue needed to be addressed. The message was that our fellow peers needed to hear this. Tab says Feaster's death was hitting extremely close to home. He adds the acting was no longer acting. It was about expressing their true emotions and feelings and having an honest dialogue that the students had to have in order to show how important this issue was. Before the performances began, Melvin considered how the play would be seen by middle and elementary age students. She wondered if the play's subject matter might be too heavy for them. She says, but something like Anthony's death made me realize this needs to be addressed. It won't go over their heads. Agerston says that in addition to counselors arriving on campus to help students sort through their feelings, conversations also took place in the classrooms. As a teacher, she says, I have to figure out how my students are feeling. A great headline. Youth gun violence has also gained the attention of the state's educational leaders. At the end of State of Urgency's run, Catherine Truitt, superintendent of NC Department of Public Instruction, invited its cast members to a meeting she hosted at the Education Building in Raleigh. Nearly 20 students, Agerston says, thrilled and excited to have a chance to be heard, sat with Truitt in a circle of chairs in a conference room. The students' big ask? Agerston says they advocated for a mental health day, a day to catch up on work, to breathe, and for more education on certain types of mental health and more counselors in the building. Shayla Beulah, a rising senior at Durham School of Technology on Hillside, says it could be a day where students are allowed to stay home and relax, to reflect on everything that's going on in their personal lives, community, and the world at large. Quote, it would be a day to meditate on you and your goals. She adds that if a health day happened at school, then time could be spent talking with their teachers, who could ask them how they're doing. Just have a group discussion, she says. Anaya Lowe says a mental health day would focus on self-care. I'm healthy, I'm doing my routine, she says, making sure everything is okay with me. Kennedy, the counseling service director, says it's imperative for mental health providers to go out into the communities. Quote, we have to get out of our professional spaces and instead go into those spaces where people are. We can use that opportunity to not tell people what they should do, but instead listen and offer opportunities and ways of how to handle what is happening. When you tell young people what to do, you take their control away. They want to gain a sense of control. Finally, for this week's issue, Savannah Wen has published an article about Durham Mayor Elaine O'Neill, who recently said she won't be seeking re-election. And she gave a little note to the public that I think I read last week. In light of the mayor's announcement, we've updated our promise tracker, which tracks her record on fulfilling her campaign promises. A spokesman for the mayor declined to provide comment for the story. So as of July of this year, the tally of O'Neill's campaign promises stands as follows. Promises kept, 10. Compromise, 2. Promise broken, 2. Stalled, 1. And in the works, 8. Now, by going to IndyWeek.com, one can get this entire follow-up, which is the list and explanation, which I won't have time to do today, and of this rating. And many Durham residents will already know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you can go to IndyWeek.com. So here we go. Prioritize the shortage of 9/11 call center staff by addressing employee stress, dedicating incentives, financial, and hiring with a trauma-informed perspective. The rating in the works. Declare racism a public health crisis. Our rating, broken. Support public health priorities for vulnerable groups, including mental health, for veterans, justice-connected youth, and immigrant communities. Promise kept. Establish an Office of Gun Violence Prevention to resource and engage communities in solving this problem from proactive rather than reactive. Broken. Address COVID as it continues to adversely impact Durham, prioritizing mental health, communities, business, and economy. Kept. Combat the growing epidemic of health misinformation. Stalled. Expand and fund the city's eviction diversion program. Kept. Support universal basic income to alleviate inability to pay for rent and other necessities. In the works. Prioritize veterans and military-connected families in terms of housing stability and security. Compromise. Ensure that residents receive training and transit to reach the new jobs coming to Durham. In the works. Also in the works, prioritize and allocate funds to ensure safe streets, sidewalks, bus stops, and shelters that are ADA compliant. Also kept, expand Durham Youth Commission. Remove barriers to ensure equitable and representative participation. Well, here comes my music telling me I can't tell you any more of her campaign promises. But again, IndyWeek.com and John Federson for IndyWeek this week, and encouraging you to peruse more of this publication if you wish. Online is the easiest way now. And we will see you next week from the North Carolina Reading Service as a podcast. That's what it is. Our initial broadcast is on Friday afternoons, and I'm recording this on the Thursday. So the music winds down, and so do my vocal cords. We'll see you, be with you next week. So long.